Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have four bills this morning for public hearing and a work session. The plan at this point is to work basically the agenda from the top down. And so with that, we're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 582.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 582 prohibits a public body from disclosing identifying information about persons applying for or licensed to carry concealed handguns absent a court order, in a pending case, or necessity for a criminal justice purpose.
All right. I have four individuals that have signed up to give testimony, but before I go with those four, Representative Thatcher, are you here on this bill?
No.
Would you like to give your testimony now?
Mr. Chair, this is my bill.
Oh. I apologize. Without the electronics, you know, all that. So would you like to give opening statements?
I would. Thank you. Thank you, Chief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Whitsett, representing District 28. There are at least two important reasons to adopt Senate Bill 582, to support the Constitution and to support public safety. We are all familiar with the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution. As you know, Mr. Chair, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Article 1, Section 27 of the Oregon Constitution states the people shall have the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state, but the military shall be kept in strict subordination to the civil power. Neither of these documents provides authority for the governments to license or permit the possession of a concealed firearm. Certainly, neither of these documents provides authority for governments to disclose who has been required to obtain a license or a permit to carry a concealed firearm. Four states, Alaska, Wyoming, Arizona, and Vermont, have recognized those constitutional rights and have adopted constitutional carry laws that recognize the right of their citizens to carry a concealed weapon without the requirement for a permit or a license. Arizona and Wyoming have adopted the constitutional carry laws this year. People carry concealed firearms for self-defense and for the defense of their families and communities. Currently, those who have a permit to carry a concealed weapon in Oregon have already undergone a rigorous examination to determine whether there is a reason why they should not be armed, as well as to determine that they know how to handle a weapon. When a dangerous crisis occurs, the ability to respond immediately is certainly more effective than waiting for the first responders to arrive. Not being certain that your intended victim is unarmed is among the greatest deterrents to gun violence. Colleagues, would you pull a loaded gun in a room if you weren't certain that all the people in that room were unarmed, and in fact, if you thought that they might be armed? Public disclosure of who has obtained a permit to carry a concealed weapon is counterproductive to public safety. Not only is it a further infringement on the right to bear arms, it actually would allow the bad guys to determine who is prepared to defend themselves and, more importantly, who is not. I urge the committee to adopt Senate Bill 592 with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And just for the record, Senator Cruz is excused today. He has other obligations for the legislature, and he may be here by the end of the meeting, but he is scheduled to be in other meetings this morning, and that's why he's not here with us today. So with that, Representative Thatcher.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburg, and I think this is a pretty straightforward bill. As you see, it's very short, and it basically says that information about concealed handgun license holders in Oregon may not be disclosed to the public, and there are exceptions for law enforcement purposes or under court order. Just for background, backing up to 1973, that was the Watergate era, and that's when Oregon's public records laws first came into being. They were designed to hold government accountable. Oregon didn't even issue a concealed handgun license until 16 years later. And back then, the information should, relating to those licenses and the applications, should have been put off limits to public disclosure, but it wasn't. So we should do that today. The problem we've run into has occurred many times in the past decade when a newspaper or some other organization will come to the sheriff's office and ask for entire list of names and information on CHL holders. And a couple of years ago, I'm sure you remember, there was a case out of Southern Oregon, ended up with a ruling in the Oregon Court of Appeals last year. The court basically said the sheriffs have to release call these names. And the sheriffs came to me and asked me to introduce legislation last session and again this session, and we're working on House Bill 2787 on the House side. You know, the people who get a CHL did not ask to be put in the public spotlight, hence the term concealed. They did not ask to have all sorts of information published about themselves or about their family or have it on file at the sheriff's office, but in order to get a concealed handgun license, they had to fill out these forms. And they did not ask to be required to get police permission for a basic civil right, and they never asked to be required to pay a fee so that they and their loved ones could feel safe. So now all this personal information they give to the police is now considered a public record. And that just shouldn't be. Here's all kinds of information about the information it's asked for on these applications is, well, quite extensive. Pretty personal, a lot of it. This is from 20 different counties right here. And some of these forms are up to 6 pages long, and they're full of all sorts of what you might call juicy private information: home, phone numbers, home addresses, social security numbers, what kinds of guns you have in your house, whether you were dishonorably discharged from the military, whether you have controlled substances that you're taking, or whether you're in diversion. There's all kinds of information to ask for, and it's all subject to disclosure. Well, most of it. And we're not just talking about actual holders, the people who actually were approved to receive their concealed handgun license. We're talking about any applicants who may have been turned down. So this legislation would cover both. These people who fill these forms out are not government entities. They're not public officials, and they're not conducting the people's business. Government records should be about government programs and government agencies and agents, not whether a single mom living in a remote area of the state has a CHL to protect her and her family. So it's not only a privacy issue, it is, like Senator Whitsitt said, it's a safety issue as well. Many of these people get permits because they are concerned about their personal safety. And you'll hear from some today, I'm sure. There are people who have been victims of horrendous crimes or they're being stalked by some crazy person. And we have compiled, I don't know, about 1,400 reasons why people will get a concealed handgun license, and went through the names were blacked out, but these were a compilation of some of the reasons that people wanted to pursue getting a license and why they don't want their personal information revealed and released to the public. And these reasons range from being victims of domestic violence with restraining orders to who are against their ex-spouses or have restraining orders against their ex-spouses. And you have sometimes there's convenience store owners who carry large sums of money late at night, and there are people who are being harassed by other folks, and they work for government agencies, and they would have a reason to want to seek protection on some of these. They work for government agencies in kind of highly sensitive areas that might cause people to be, considering them enemies. And I'm not worried about these gun owners. These are not the folks we need to worry about. I'm worried about the gun owners who are not following the law, and they are the bad guys out to do us harm. And obviously they're not going to be going down to the sheriff's office to be asking permission to get a concealed handgun license. They don't have to worry about their personal information being exposed because somebody has filed a public records request. So I would ask that we protect citizens' privacy and safety by passing Senate Bill 582. Thanks.
Great, thank you. Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Thatcher. You said that all the information is subject to disclosure, and then you said, well, most of it. So do you know which is not subject to disclosure?
I believe there are things like social security numbers would not be, just because of previous law, but the information in there widely would be open to such a search.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much, Representative. The first two in the panel we're going to bring up is John Powell and Kevin Stark, and then we'll follow up with Dan Lucas and Rachel Lucas. Is there anyone else who's going to want to testify on 582 besides the ones that have signed up? So, Kevin or John, I'm not sure who wants to go first.
Members of the committee, for the record, I am Kevin Starrett, representing the Oregon Firearms Federation. Obviously, we're here in support of this bill. I have given you copies, and you may have already received electronic copies of testimony from Sheriff Glenn Palmer of Grant County, who came to testify on the identical bill in the House, couldn't make it here, so he asked me to give you his House testimony in support of this bill as well. And there's a couple of things that I wanted to point out that I think got lost in the discussions last session. For people like myself, everybody knows what I do. It's not no surprise to anybody that I have a permit to carry a gun, but there are a lot of people who are in occupations that are not necessarily friendly to people who own guns, and I don't think those people's private information should put them at jeopardy for their occupations or their livelihood. The bill has strong support from the police, who the Jackson County Sheriff has incurred an enormous expense trying to safeguard the privacy of his residents, and I think if we pass this, that this will protect our law enforcement people from that kind of problem. The other thing I'd like to point out is that these lists have already been compromised to a certain extent, and they've been used for fundraising and direct mail campaigns. And I think that's an unfortunate reality and something that shouldn't be allowed to continue. So with that, I'll just take any questions if you have them.
All right. John, you'll give us your testimony, then we'll open up for questions.
Chair Rosansky, members of the committee. My name is John C. Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association today. The sheriffs support Senate Bill 582 for three primary reasons. Those of expectations, security, and I forget the other one. But in terms of expectation, the sheriffs believe that the public expects that when they apply for a CHL or hold a CHL, that information will be held private. Second, the several sheriffs have conducted public opinion polling in their counties, and all have come back with overwhelming support for the privacy of this information. And thirdly, the security aspect. There are many instances when people apply for and hold a concealed handgun license because they are in fear of their safety. And if the individual to whom they fear could easily access this information, it could be something that could, you know, set off an unbalanced person. And the sheriffs just believe that it should be private information. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you.
Well, I looked at it and see your hand going.
Sorry.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I wanted to ask you, John, you heard Representative Thatcher talk about how public records laws are designed to hold governments accountable. And I'm the first to say that I'm sure that most of our sheriffs, if not all of our sheriffs, are doing an excellent job in their work. However, what if there were an instance where somebody needed to find out if, in fact, the sheriff's office was properly granting somebody's application for a concealed handgun license? How would that happen without access to some public records? Because Representative Thatcher said, that's the reason for public records laws, is to hold government accountable. So how would you have that accountability?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Bonamici, I believe that would be in a criminal matter. If a sheriff is illegally granting concealed handgun license, that being a crime, I think there's an exception in statute that for criminal proceedings, these records can be received by a court.
Thank you. Is that your understanding? Follow-up? Is that your understanding, too, Mr. Sterritt? Is that what the criminal exception for?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Bonamici, I frankly cannot imagine the situation you've described. And to me, it seems no more believable than to say, I have a right to have your tax records to be sure that the Department of Revenue is properly charging you. I think it may have made sense at a time when concealed handgun licenses were given out so rarely that it would have been a good way to demonstrate that a sheriff was only giving it to his friends. But given the process that's required and the necessary interaction with the state police who have to conduct fingerprint background checks, the idea that sheriffs would be out there giving concealed handgun licenses to people who aren't qualified seems to me so statistically insignificant that I can't even imagine it happening.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I have Dan Lucas and Rachel Lucas. And lastly, is there going to be anyone else who'd want to testify on 582? Good morning.
Good morning.
So if you can identify yourself for the record and give your testimony.
I'm Rachel Lucas, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 582. I'm very nervous, and last year, 2 years ago when this bill came before me, I remained anonymous. And this year that's not even possible because there are people on this panel who know me personally, so that would be ridiculous. But the reason that I'm a sexual assault victim, and yet last weekend I got up and performed in front of hundreds of people, and I'm way more nervous now.
Just take your time, deep breath.
But the reason I'm nervous is because this opens up those wounds. To even think about this opens up, and it takes me back into that place where that violation occurred. And I know that there are many, many sexual assault victims who cannot come forward and speak like this because they haven't had the opportunity to do the healing. There hasn't been that much time passed, but those wounds never do go away. And just to even think about having our records opened up to the public reviolates us in that sort of way. And to talk about that phenomenon of that reviolation, when I was sexually assaulted, my the media covered it, and the media was so careful to protect my privacy at the time that they covered this event. And the courts were also careful to protect my privacy. They actually had me subpoenaed as a witness and instead of having my name out on the public records. And I think the reason that the media and the courts and the government understand why crime victims and sexual assault victims need to have that layer of privacy is because that violation breaks an intactness in your being, which I have to expose right now to you, that is unnatural, and it's like things get inside that shouldn't get inside. So the media and the courts create a privacy bandage that acts like the skin that should be there, the skin that's been broken of your own persona. And that's why intuitively I believe they do that. And by having our records exposed, that takes that bandage off. And it lets that infection in. And part of that infection, an example of that, would be that my perpetrator can, from jail, without go to a computer and access not only information about whether or not I carry a CHL, or no, it can never tell whether I'm carrying a CHL, whether or not I've sought to obtain a CHL license, but also where I'm living, all kinds of personal information about me, and he can go in on that wound and sort of voyeur my life, which is something I can't even do to him without going through a court system that trips wires and lets him know I'm concerned about him. So it re-victimizes us in ways. I know that there's been a lot of press right now about Neil Goldschmidt, and one of the things that came out was that he used to go to his victim's dorm room and just stand there And that wouldn't be intimidating if he hadn't already violated that woman. So just the possibility that my perpetrator can voyeur my records goes in on that woman. And again, so the government and the media should continue to act as that bandage of privacy, especially because in order to obtain a CHL, this information is required of me to comply with the law as a citizen. And so if the government in Oregon is continuing to require that information of me in order to comply with the law, I would ask and plead that our government would continue to protect my privacy if they're requiring that of me. And not just me, but all citizens. And I thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you for coming forward. Thank you for sharing your testimony. Dan?
My name is Dan Lucas, and I'm from Beaverton. And I'm here today as a CHL holder, and also as a husband of a CHL holder, and also as the dad of a CHL holding daughter. And I want to protect all people who are, I want to protect the privacy of all CHL holders. When the Salem newspaper made a request for CHL holder private information last year, it was another example of the ongoing abuse of the Sunshine Laws. As Representative Thatcher mentioned, those laws were created to ensure that the internal workings of our government were kept in the open, they were not created to abuse the privacy of citizens required to provide personal information to the government. Even the fact that a person has a CHL needs to be kept private in order for them to be able to defend themselves. I'm here to ask you today to please support Senate Bill 582. The current law is completely inadequate in protecting CHL holders' private information. The current law leaves the sheriffs twisting in the wind regarding when they are required or permitted to release CHL application information and which information should or can be released. An Associated Press Oregon Freedom of Information audit conducted as a part of Sunshine Week 2005 revealed a significant lack of uniformity in how private CHL application information is handled by different counties. And you all should have a copy of that chart. And if you look at that chart, you can see that the way that the different counties treat these requests is all over the board.
There is no consistency. The exact same request by volunteer auditors across the state resulted in some counties correctly denying the access to the private information, some counties turning over the five most recent CHL applications as requested, and sheriff's offices in at least two counties, Lane and Deschutes, expressing willingness to provide the auditors with their entire list of CHL holders. A 2005 article written for the Bend Bulletin revealed the then Deschutes County Sheriff would have no problem releasing the roughly 5,000 names of CHL holders in his county after redacting Social Security numbers and personal medical information. Redacting that information is good, but it's not enough. The Deschutes County CHL application also contained address, other states lived in as an adult, home and work phone numbers, employer, occupation, date of birth, height, weight, residences for the last 3 years, names, addresses, and phone numbers of two character references, as well as answers to citizenship and criminal history questions. And that's just one county's application. In 2007, a third county, Multnomah, went beyond expressing a willingness and actually turned over their entire database of 12,000 CHL holders to the Oregonian. The Oregonian then went on to use the CHL holders' private information to harass school teachers in Multnomah County. Newspapers in other states, including Tennessee and Virginia, have made CHL holders' private information available on the Internet after obtaining the CHL databases. The current broad discretion given to sheriffs and the lack of clarity in the law would be resolved by House Bill 582. Supporting House Bill 582 will help produce consistent protection of the private information and CHL records. Finally, to address the erroneous concern about a person's so-called right to know if someone's carrying a gun, revealing law-abiding citizens' private CHL information does nothing to help someone know who might be carrying a gun. It only tells you who can legally carry a concealed gun. And there are many people with a CHL who rarely or never actually carry concealed. It does nothing to tell someone who has guns in their home. No CHL is required for that. Most importantly, it does nothing to let someone know who is illegally carrying a concealed gun, and these, of course, are the people who are truly dangerous. For all these reasons, I ask you to please protect CHL holders' private information by passing Senate Bill 582.
Great, thank you. Questions for him? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dan and Rachel. Nice to see you again. I wanted to make sure that you knew that under Oregon law, the victims of domestic violence and sexual assault can already shield their records under existing law and also can participate in Oregon's address confidentiality program to create an address that's a substitute address for public records. So I wanted to make sure that you knew about that. I also crossed out your address on your testimony, which you put on your testimony, because this is public record. So I encourage my colleagues to do the same thing so that your address is not here on this testimony. But I thank you again for coming forward. But I wanted to ask you, Rachel, what about somebody who is a victim of domestic violence and she wants to know if her perpetrator is carrying a concealed handgun license?
If her perpetrator is carrying a concealed weapon, if her perpetrator has any kind of lawsuit against him that she's filed, he is disallowed from having a CHL. If he has one, it will be taken away from him. So he will no longer have the legal right to carry a concealed weapon. And if he is of the mindset to violate that, any restraining order, he would probably also be of the mindset to violate any requirement to have a concealed carry license or a valid one. If I were in that situation, I myself would seek to have my own concealed carry license. You do bring up a good point, too, that I did not know that Oregon had that. Actually, my perpetrator and this event did not occur in Oregon, so I'm not sure if Oregon would protect me from my perpetrator. I'm also not sure if, as you point out, I also do not know that. I'm not sure how you would get that word out to people to let them know that they have that so that they could protect their records. That's one of the problems with this is that one of the things that we do as sexual assault victims is we try to hide and create that skin of privacy. I'm probably none of you know that about me. So even thinking about having to come forward to obtain the kind of security that we would need in order to protect that is a violation. When I go to find out whether my perpetrator is currently in jail or out on probation. He did get out on probation or parole. He did reoffend with a child and now has another Class C felony against him. So I do feel I need, in order to even find out, that I have to go through other people and other government agencies, and that trips wires that allow him to know that I'm looking for him and am concerned about him. So any of the things that a sexual assault victim or a crime victim has to do proactively to protect themselves causes a risk and brings up all of those painful things. Just keeping our records private by law, which I would expect since those were required by law, would take away all that need. Thank you.
As a dad, I have a daughter who has not been the victim of a sexual assault, and I would like to keep it that way. So I want all the daughters out there in Oregon to be able to carry concealed and not have that information made public.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. And with your permission, as Senator Bonamici said, I'll have your address.
Yes, actually, I put that on there this time. This is the first time only because the last time when I testified over at the House, they said it might not be accepted, which, again, shows you exactly what we're up against. I didn't put it on there for that exact reason. So please take it off since that was what I was told. And, again, it only illustrates
as far as I'm concerned, as long as you come up here and identify yourself for the record, that's good enough.
Okay, that's what it was.
So we'll have, staff take care of that. Again, thank you for coming forward. I do have one other person that appears who wants to give testimony. Mr. Viperman? Ripperman? Please come forward. You'll state your name for the record.
Andy Viperman.
And your testimony, sir.
I'm in wholehearted favor of this bill. I have to say from the beginning, I find it a bit of irony in having to identify myself in order to protect my other information or to protect any information. What we have here is a bill that says it's not a matter of a public record who I am, where I live, what my source number is, and everything else that's on my application, and yet I have to come in and state my name to have any validity to my testimony. And my testimony is that I am a CHL holder. I have been for multiple years. Just a note of irony on my own part. In terms of the bill itself, again, I'm in wholehearted favor of it. I am a CHL holder. I do not carry, in the last 6 years that I've had a CHL, I believe, I've been thinking this morning, I believe I've carried twice. I have my CHL because when I want to carry, I want to carry legally. I want to have that legal capacity, but I very rarely actually utilize that capacity. Regardless of how often I carry, I think the right to carry is important. I believe it is a right. I believe it's a permission that has to exist. And as to who I am and all the other information that's on the application, in my opinion, I'm vetted thoroughly enough by the sheriff. I don't need to be vetted by somebody who wants to know if I would be a good target or anyone else. Last thing I would mention, seems to me there is a budgetary, albeit minor, budgetary concept involved here also, and that is to the sheriff's offices around the state who, if this bill doesn't pass, would then have the responsibility of not only taking the applications and filing them away, but adding to and subtracting from a master list, adding, updating, editing, et cetera, keeping it available for publication and circulation, making sure that it's accurate. That uses staff time, it uses other resources, mechanical and otherwise, that if this bill passes, they won't have to do. In times where we're looking for every dollar hidden in every plastic egg, this is one that we can easily open and save the sheriff's offices, thus the counties, thus the taxpayers a few dollars every year, and it doesn't cost the newspapers anything. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
That's going to conclude our public hearing on Senate Bill 582. So I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing. And we have another one up that's Council is going to be covering, Senate Bill 619.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 619 provides the owner of property acquired by condemnation agreement with the right of repurchase to all or part of the property if the property was not used for a public purpose within 10 years, if the condemnation agreement fails to include provisions required by ORS 35.385 sub 1A or B, which specify a reasonable amount of time for condemner to use or use within 10 years or waiver of the right to repurchase. It applies retroactively, declares an emergency effective on passage.
All right, thank you. I have three people that are scheduled to give testimony. I'm going to have all three come up at the same time. Dave Honeycutt, Paul Mather, and Linda Ludwig. And Dave, I'm going to let you start off since you're in the position four. We'll let Linda go second since she's against, and then Paul will let you clean up as neutral. I love it. A little of everything. You know, all at once.
Shades of gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of SB 619. Let me give you a little bit of procedural background on how the current condemnation process works. I think that's important to explain what it is that we're trying to do with this bill. Under current law, when a governing body wishes to condemn property, they're required by statute to adopt an ordinance or resolution specifying their intent to condemn the property and then directing typically staff or maybe maybe the city attorney, DOJ, county council, whoever, to prepare an appraisal and make an offer to the property owner. If during that period of time when they're attempting to negotiate terms for the sale and transfer of the property, an agreement cannot be reached, then the governing body is authorized at that point to issue or to file a condemnation action against the property owner, naming the property owner as the defendant in the action. The way the current law reads, if the property owner and the governing body are not able to agree and a condemnation lawsuit is required to be filed and that thus is filed, litigated, and then a judgment is entered, under the current law, the property owner, as part of the judgment, the court will specify a time for the governing body to make a use of that property, and if the use isn't made within that specified time, then the property owner is given the right to repurchase the property, or alternatively, the property owner and the governing body, the property owner can agree to waive that provision and eliminate the right of repurchase. What this bill does, and the only thing that this bill does, is extend that right of repurchase to the period of time after the governing body adopts the resolution, but prior to the commencement of the lawsuit. So in other words, if I, as a property owner, am approached by a city, the city has adopted a resolution authorizing the condemnation of my property. I'm approached by the city. They prepare an appraisal. They come to me and they say, okay, here's what we believe the market value of, for your property is. I hire counsel. I'm not interested in selling my property, so I hire counsel and say, look, you know, I don't want to sell my property. And the counsel says, well, my counsel says, look, the resolution that authorizes the condemnation states the intent of the city to take this property for a use that's clearly a public use. I can't stop this from happening. What you should do now is negotiate the best price that you can for your property, and hopefully we can short-circuit litigation. If I take that advice, agree on a sale and sell the property to the city, then under this bill, as part of that, as part of the agreement to sell the property to the city, I would have the right to repurchase the property. So the bill doesn't change the period of time in which the city has to make a public use. It doesn't change the way that they make the market value offer. It doesn't change any of the particulars. It doesn't change the interplay between this law and any other provision in the condemnation statutes. It simply extends the right to repurchase, which a property owner currently has, if a judgment is entered in a condemnation action, to that period of time between the time that the city or the governing body adopts the ordinance or resolution and the time that the lawsuit is filed, to cover those situations where the property owner and the governing body can reach agreement on market value and sell the property. Having said that, and that's really all the bill does, having said that, I know that both ODOT and the League have some concerns. We were successful in the 2009 session, as I think the chair may remember, with a condemnation bill that managed to work for everyone. I know the League's got some concerns, and as well as ODOT, and we may be able to reach agreement at least on some of those concerns. The retroactive portion of this bill is an area where we may not be able to reach agreement, but there are other issues where we may be able to reach agreement. So I'd ask the chair and the committee to entertain us and give us a little bit of time for me to meet with both ODOT and the League to see if we can make some amendments that would be friendly to all and bring those back to the committee.
All right, that's fine. Linda?
Chair, members of the committee, can you hear me? It's a little bit hard to tell right here. Thank you. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. We are definitely opposed to the bill as it's written, particularly with Section 2 that would change, we believe, the terms and conditions of existing legal contracts. That's the retroactive portion of this bill.
We question if it is actually unconstitutional because we'd be interfering with the rights of those contract parties. The bill would give something that wasn't provided for or considered when the compensation was negotiated in the first place between those parties. We don't know how many valid contracts there are out there or how many that would be affected by Section 2. As Mr. Honeycutt said, we would be willing to continue the conversations regarding amendment to the bill. However, we're hard and fast in opposition to the retroactive portion of that bill. And I would note that I believe you got some testimony from a Mr. Doyle in McMinnville that this bill actually generated from. I respectfully want to acknowledge the comments of Mr. Doyle, and I'm in no here representing the interest of McMinnville, but there is that situation where this bill generated from, which we also have some concerns generally about a statewide perspective for an individual situation. And I'm aware that Mr. Doyle is not present because he actually lives in Columbia a good portion of this, of his time. But I would say, having reviewed the comments here, if the committee is very interested in the fact set of what is going on in McMinnville as they entertain this bill, I would request that we receive some information from the city of McMinnville. Having done so, I would believe that that situation from their perspective might look a little different than Mr. Doyle's comments here.
Okay. I guess all I can say is, since you're part of the League of Cities, it seems like you can reach out to McMinnville and get whatever information that you feel is necessary. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Transportation, here to testify on Senate Bill 619. Senate Bill 619 would allow property owners to repurchase real property acquired by the Oregon Department of Transportation for projects if the property has not been used for public use within 10 years. The repurchase would be at the original acquisition price plus interest. This right could be waived in writing by the property owner at acquisition, and also, as we've talked about, this bill is retroactive. For the majority of the property that ODOT acquires, for the majority of our projects, we acquire the project, go out in the next year or two and build the project and build those public improvements, and it would not be an issue. But for many of our major projects that are significant in size, significant in dollar amounts, and reach over many years and sometimes decades, this bill would create maybe some unintended consequences that I want to talk about. I think probably the best way to illustrate that is maybe with some examples about how funding gets stretched out over many years and how our planning process gets stretched out throughout those years as well. Looking just west of Salem and Highway 22 is a good example. Highway 22 in a bypass that was built near Rickreall in the 70s purchased additional property at the intersection with 99W in the future planning efforts of an interchange at that location. At the time of construction, with the bypass, the signalized intersection was adequate, and it wasn't until many decades later until we needed an interchange. Funding was acquired, and we actually built that interchange. But in good practices of planning for highway purposes, the acquisition of that right-of-way for our planning, for the property owner's planning, for the community's planning, that right-of-way was purchased back in the 70s. Similarly, east of Salem on Highway 22 in the 50s, actually, we purchased right-of-way for a four-lane highway on Highway 22. For many years, a two-lane facility in that location served the needs. But as we saw growth in that area, the additional right-of-way that was purchased in the 50s, we recently built a four-lane facility on. As you look to the Jobs and Transportation Act that was passed last session, there's a number of very large projects on there that will go through a similar planning process, a similar kind of life cycle in their development. Highway 62 in the Medford area, the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass, and the Sunrise Corridor are all examples where we have very large projects. We've gone through extensive planning processes with these projects, and we're going to scale back and build a somewhat limited facility relative to the ultimate plan for those corridors. However, given the planning, given our funding constraints, we will be out buying additional right-of-way for those four-lane, six-lane facilities in the future for future interchanges and future improvements in those corridors. Those future improvements will likely take more than 10 years to acquire all the funding needed for those. So again, I just wanted to point out some unintended consequences with this bill. The retroactive would be certainly applied to right-of-ways we've acquired in the past, and looking forward, even with those large projects I described, this bill would create some issues for us in planning and financing our projects.
Great, thank you. Questions or comments? Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mather, or whoever wants to answer this, I see these eminent domain procedures that reach out a decade or more as a constraint on economic development and job growth. The state or the government entity has the right to take that property whenever they need it. And so you have the opportunity for someone who has that property to build and enjoy and create jobs on that property for maybe 10 or 20 years prior to the time when you need it. When you need it, you can still take it. You have to pay what it's worth, but you can still take it. Would you address that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Woodson, I'll address that from an ODOT standpoint. And with a project I'm very familiar with the Highway 62 improvements in the Medford area, we've been planning for that corridor, for that improvement, for a number of years. During those number of years, several property owners have come to us and said, we want to sell our property for one reason or another. And we've come to a mutual agreement through a willing seller, if you will, to purchase those properties. During that time period, we have not gone out and condemned property. That would be something, as you point out, that we would save till later in the process. But there's a number of times where we have willing sellers. We do know we need that property for our projects, and we are out purchasing those properties. Some properties we do damage, or we do acquire for, say, the two-lane facility, and then eventually need the four-lane facility. So it makes sense to acquire the property once we've already entered negotiations with that property owner to acquire the full property that we need from that owner at that time. So I guess in summary, it depends a little bit on a project-by-project or parcel-by-parcel aspect as we deal with each one of these. But in general, we don't go out in a very proactive 10-year type horizon looking to buy properties through eminent domain to buy them for the project. Those are reserved for later in the process, as you point out, again, unless we touch that property as I described.
I understand your response. ODOT currently does not use eminent domain to acquire property with a 10 or 20 year window of opportunity. You go out and buy from willing sellers. And if you, is that correct?
Chair Przanski, Senator Woodson, in general, that's true. Again, there's special circumstances where that's not always true, but that's our preferred way our standard way of dealing with those issues. But it's not universal. There are times where we will use eminent domain in certain circumstances to acquire those properties.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess my thought here is that the response doesn't really address eminent domain largely. It's eminent domain. It really isn't a willing buyer and a willing seller. Eminent domain is an unwilling seller that is being forced. So, I mean, yeah.
All right, other questions?
Can I briefly respond to that, Senator?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that one thing to point out in the bill does authorize, if you have a willing seller, nothing in the bill prohibits the condemning body and the seller from entering into an agreement waiving the right to repurchase or specifying a reasonable time to repurchase. That's Section 1. The language that's changed in Section 1 of the bill. So that wouldn't, in that situation, if you have a willing seller and the ordinance is adopted as part of the agreement, the negotiated agreement, I would suspect that the condemning body would demand that the seller either waive their right to repurchase or specify a reasonable time, whatever the condemning body thought was a reasonable time.
right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 619? Not seeing anyone, we're going to close. We're changing counsel, so we'll stand at ease for a moment. And we're going to open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 760. Aaron?
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Both 760 and 761 will pertain to alternative incarceration programs, also known as AIP. The first of these, 760, modifies the amount of credit that you would receive for a successful completion of an AIP program. Essentially, the modification is if you have an individual who's serving consecutive sentences, they could now, under this bill, receive an AIP completion discount on the duration of both of those sentences and not just the lattermost of those sentences.
I think what I'm going to go ahead and do is open up a public hearing on both of these since they are so close in tie. So we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing also on 761. And I believe we're going to have the same individuals testifying on each of the bills. I have three that are scheduled to testify at this point. And with that, I'd like to have all three come up. Karen, I believe I'm going to say Nibbler. I'm just trying to make sure I got the last name correct. Elizabeth Kushwa and Ginger Martin. And regarding testimony, if you can identify any specific part of your testimony that deals with one of the two bills as to which one it pertains to, or if your comments in general, that would be acceptable as well. And let's see, the way this looks like, we have another one of those fancy panels. We have a for, against, and neutral. So, Karen, you get to go first. Elizabeth will go second, and Ginger will clean up.
Okay. Chair Pozanski, I'm Karen Nibbler, and I represent the Oregon League of Women Voters of Oregon. And we're here to support both 760 and 761. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan, grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. I did send this letter over, so you should have a copy of it. The League of Women Voters of Oregon has a position on adult corrections that strongly favors increased use of alternatives to incarceration where possible. The League also believes that comprehensive transitional programs are essential for successful completion of rehabilitation for each inmate released or paroled from a correctional facility. These bills would allow early release after serving an incarceration of at least a year when an offender has earned time credits. The League is in favor of incentives to complete educational or treatment programs within institutions, and in favor of efforts to rehabilitate offenders who will return to the community. Transitional programs are preparing offenders to successfully negotiate the potentially hazardous return to family and work responsibilities. And I believe that those transitional programs are funded in the last session, so that they're still existing at this point. And in addition, the shorter prison terms could result in savings for the correctional system, which translates into increased funding for correctional programs as well as for other agencies within the public safety system. Thanks for the opportunity to discuss the legislation.
Thank you.
Good morning, Senator Pozanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa with the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and you'll forgive me for referring to the notes. I'm not nearly as extemporaneous as some of the district attorneys are. Both of these bills facilitate the earlier release for defendants serving consecutive sentences, and our concern is especially with both bills with the retroactivity portion of them. That stands in contrast to the level of accountability contemplated by the court, the parties, and the victims at the time of sentencing. Specifically, consecutive sentences are reserved for cases that the court finds certain criteria merit greater sentences. The defendant was already incarcerated at the time of the current crime of conviction, or that the crimes are not part of the same continuous or uninterrupted course of conduct, If the crimes do arise out of the same continuous or uninterrupted course of conduct, the court may choose to impose consecutive sentences when the defendant's behavior demonstrated a willingness to commit more than one criminal offense, or that those offenses caused a greater qualitative harm to the victim or to a different victim. These findings are now required during the process or are stipulated in the agreements. In addition, the court may choose which sentence runs first under current law. The consecutive sentences may not be of the same duration. For example, under current law, the court may choose to run the longer sentence first and the shorter sentence second as it increases the amount of release time. That is for an offender, for example, they may find more dangerous. Conversely, they may decide to run the shorter sentence first for the current earned time, 20%, and then run the longer sentence last to have a greater carrot to give to that defendant to get out earlier. From a more general perspective, I think that the district attorneys feel pretty strongly about preserving the infrastructure of the system. You have heard several bills already that address increasing county supervision or monitoring, shortening incarceration sentences for good reasons and for reasons that deal with our budgetary crisis today. Our concern, I think, is from a more global perspective, which of these would be best? You're going to be hearing this, you're going to be hearing many more after this. And which of these would be best, and which would do the least harm to public safety? It's difficult to discern, not seeing them all laid out side by side. In addition, I'd just like to remind the committee that as a result of 3508 and then Senate Bill 1007, that earned time will be increasing again from 20 to 30%, potentially this summer. So that would increase, again, the additional amount of time on. I'd like to add a caveat that the district attorneys are in favor of treatment, are in favor of transitional programs. This is not a slam on those kinds of issues, but our concern is that the expectations that the court chose at the time of sentencing, the parties agreed to, and that the victims expected. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Ginger?
Chair Przanski, members of the Judiciary Committee, I am Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for Transitional Services with the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide information on Senate Bill 760 and 761. As you know, AIP programs allow inmates to earn 20% off of their prison sentence when they successfully complete those programs, in addition to the 20% that they might earn through good behavior. Both of these bills change the way this calculation is made. Under current law, sentence reductions are calculated on the sentence being served just prior to release. This is pretty straightforward if there is one sentence, but where there are consecutive sentences, the time reduction is calculated only on the last sentence of the string. Senate Bill 760 would allow the department to calculate the time cut for sentences in a consecutive string using the total term of eligible sentences. So only those sentences that the judge has made eligible for AIP would be included in the calculation. Senate Bill 761 includes that same provision and also would allow the department to calculate the maximum time cut based on the entire sentence, not on the reduced sentence after the application of potential 20% earned time. That would result in inmates entering AIP earlier than they currently are able to. I would point out that neither of these bills changes who is eligible for AIP, nor the fact that the judge needs to include AIP eligibility in the sentence, whether it is a concurrent or consecutive or single sentence. If either of these bills were to pass, there would be equality in eligibility between inmates who have consecutive sentences and those who have concurrent sentences. An inmate who has a 30-month sentence and an inmate who has two 15-month consecutive sentences would be eligible to enter the AIP program at the same time. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Comments? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bills 760 or 761? Not seeing anyone rush forward. We're going to close those public hearings. And we have one more matter, and we're waiting for Bill Taylor.
stand at ease? Yeah, can we stand at ease and go on recess for a moment? All right, we're back on the record, and at this point, we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 43.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 43 comes to you from the Department of Justice. You have the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments in front of you. It moves a cap on child support arrearages based on the applicable federal minimum hourly wage standards, so the amount withheld for each month is amount equal to the last ordered monthly support order. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 1 amendments allow a greater capturing of PERS if there's child support obligation owed. And the Second Amendment limits the amount that can be withheld when the withholding is from Social Security disability benefits, black lung benefits, veterans disability benefits, limits the amount that can be withheld for arrearages if the person has an obligation to pay current child support or unable to meet basic needs. Chair, members of the committee, there are several people here that can address the amendments, Gene Fogarty, Sybil Hebb, and Kate Richardson.
All right. Anyone going to want more detail? I assume we will on the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s.
I just want to know, Mr. Chair, if these are consensus amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are people
nodding heads.
I've been told yes, they are.
No. Thank you.
Based on the heads nodding up and down, we'll take that as a yes. All right, so then why don't we go ahead and do this? My understanding is that we don't have fiscals on either of these two amendments, but we can adopt the amendments into the bill and then wait for the fiscals to reach us. Is that correct, or do we have to go back and do...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, you could adopt the ones and twos, and the fiscals will be here momentarily. Okay. They were requested at the end of last week.
Okay. So momentarily, meaning we're probably not going to vote the bill today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I assume at the end of this testimony you'd like to adjourn for the day. So.
Okay, so they're not that quick of moments. All right. So with that, the chair will take a...
One motion. Okay.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 43.
Senator Bonamici moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 43. Any questions, comments? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 43.
Senator Bonamici now moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 43. Any discussion? Comments? Any objection? So ordered. All right. So at this point, we have the bill, Senate Bill 43, amended by the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s. And, Council, Bill, if you could... do whatever magic that needs to be done to get the fiscal that would cover both of those, either individual ones or together, and we'll wait until they're back. So do we know when they're supposed to be?
Chair, members of the committee, I would assume that we'll have them probably today or tomorrow, so we could probably put this bill on for work session on Wednesday.
Are you here on Wednesday?
Chair, members of the committee, I am.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and carry over Senate Bill 43 as amended with the Dash 1s and Dash 2s for additional work session this Wednesday, which would be the 9th of March, Wednesday the 9th. All right. With that, I'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 43, and I believe that takes care of our work for today.
Chairman.
And so we'll be adjourned until tomorrow. We're scheduled to be here at 8:30. Thank you.